Welcome to Sagas and Sass Season 4, brought to you by Geek Saga Entertainment. This is Episode 71, and we're continuing our discussion of Dark Age, the fifth installment in Pierce Brown's Red Rising saga.
I'm fellow Sagas and Sass host Nick, and this episode covers Lysander's POS chapters from Craft and Treason, Parts 2 and 3 of Dark Age.
And I'm regular guest host Seth, here to remind you that our Red Rising coverage is spoiler-free outside of the chapters we cover in each episode.
Oh, and by the way, the opinions are those of us as individuals and don't necessarily reflect the opinions of the show as a whole, though, let's be real, usually we're all on the same page, or at least very close to it.
Last but not least, don't forget to check out our Patreon with 10 tiers ranging from $1 a month to $40 a month. It offers tons of ways to support us and receive some great perks in return, including access to the video recordings of these episodes within 24 hours of us recording them. Usually less, and early access to our podcast episodes. You can find us at patreon.com/geeksaga_entertainment.
Lysander might still be alive, but he's badly injured and trudging through the desert, and for some reason, reminiscing about Octavia abusing him as a child in her attempts to teach him the mind's eye. But hey, maybe thinking about that is better than thinking about how Roan and the Praetorians were captured by rising soldiers, how Ajax lost at Heliopolis, about his oozing burn wound, or Kalindor's cauterized but rancid arm stump, or how they're definitely going to run out of water long before they can escape the desert. In fact, Cicero goes so far as to suggest that they dump the Greys who are with them to give themselves a better chance at survival. Of course, Lysander refuses to go along with this, and so they keep trudging on, at least until a sandstorm blows in. There's a crashed bomber nearby, and they run for it, but Lysander is dragging them down and knows Kalindora won't make it as long as she's helping him. He urges her to go on without him and then dives into a nearby Hydra burrow, a gamble that pays off in the end, because not only does he survive the storm, he also doesn't get eaten by the Hydra whose burrow he's sharing, and when the storm blows over and Kalindora and the others are picked up by rising soldiers who are passing by, he doesn't share their fate. Really? Everything's coming up, Lysander! Okay, well, maybe not quite everything. He'd been thinking for a while that it felt like they were being followed, and guess what? He was right! And who has been following them? Why, it's Apollonius Al-Valleyrath, hiding under a ghost cloak. Oh, and he reveals himself, vocally anyway, just in time to warn Lysander that there are some men on their way to kill him. Not more rising soldiers, oh no. It's Seneca, Ajax's Dukes, aka his right-hand man, along with 7 Peerless Guard Golds. 8-1, but Lysander uses a weapon from the down bomber to blind his opponents. Okay, and himself as well, but it's good, y'all, because he has the mind's eye, remember? Needless to say, Lysander wins that fight and survives another day. Though Apple isn't too happy with him for refusing to trade knowledge of the mind's eye for his help in getting out of the desert, which means that he leaves Lysander behind and even takes Seneca's grav boots. But hey, lots of people have tried to kill Lysander, and yet here he is. So this is just one more thing for him to survive.
And survive he does, though when he reaches his destination, the city of Erebos, he finds it drowned, its dam having failed because of the storm. And as if that's not enough, the road into the city is lined with impaled Martians, the Fear Knight's work, of course. Lysander approaches one of the soldiers, planning to grant the man's death request, but silly Lysander, helping others is for pixies! Meaning, obviously the area is mined, though with traps instead of bombs, so he ends up wrapped in a attack net, gathered up by Atlas's Gorgons, and deposited in their nearby villain lair, where he immediately meets Alexander and his Knights of Elysium. Or is it Arcosian Knights? Either way, Lysander tells them he's a Mercurian named Cato. We've heard that name before. Reveals that Darrow did in fact win at Heliopolis and therefore earns their trust, or at least Alexander's trust. Oh, and for a hot minute, he is tortured like the rest of them have been, which does help his whole bullshit story. Eventually, though, Atlas returns, and when Lysander is brought to him, he immediately tries to use the mind's eye, which Atlas immediately puts the kibosh on because apparently he could do it back. Okay. Let's set that aside for a moment because the conversation between Lysander and the Fear Knight is elucidating, to say the least. Atlas reveals that Ajax has been Atalantia's sex toy for longer than he should have been age-wise. And oh, also that Atalantia is planning on releasing some crazy bioweapon to kill whoever she needs to in order to take back Mercury. For herself. Because hey, fuck the Votums and whoever else she promised to help, right? To his credit, much as we hate to give him any, Lysander is against the latter and offers a different option. That being to continue using his secret identity as Cato and to, quote, take Atlas captive, unquote, and lead the Howlers who are imprisoned in an escape with Atlas as their, quote, captive, unquote.
And holy shit, y'all, this plan actually works. Granted, the Knights of Elysium or Arcosian Knights or whatever they want to call themselves keep dying along the way, but they are able to make their way through the cave system, even braving a cavern of milk bats, extremely awful carnivorous carved bats, on their way to a garage that conveniently houses the grav bikes they need to flee in the direction of the Rising's HQ. In the end, only Lysander, and Atlas survive the journey. And of course, Lysander comes under extreme scrutiny because how could his pixie-ass self survive that situation when the Knights of Elysium, Arcosian Knights, didn't? But hey, it's that good old plot convenience mind's eye to the rescue again because it allows Lysander to pass all of their tests, even as he's half shitting himself every time he has to come face to face with Darrow. Thankfully for Lysander, he has friends in high places. There's a low place. Anyway, in this case, Glorastes, who demands that his longtime bud Cato be released to, you know, keep working for Darrow. And since Darrow doesn't really have a choice, Lysander is transported to the Master Maker's home. And even though he knows he's under surveillance, he feels like he finally has a chance to put an end to Atalantia's devious bioweapon plan. The problem is, that whole surveillance thing is actually a problem until Glorastes takes Lysander down into his wine cellar by way of a poorly aged wine, because apparently the monitoring spike they installed won't work down in the cellar. That's convenient. Particularly as it allows them to have a whole conversation about their history and what Atalantia is up to and how they can stop it and get rid of Darrow and all these, insert appropriate whiny voice here, awful whiny rising soldiers. Soon after, they're able to freeze Lysander's monitoring spike, and that's when things get really real, or something, because Glorastes' servants come round to pledge their loyalty, and Lysander responds by promising he will help the Mercurians take back their home from the Martian Marauders. His words. We promise. Not ours. Cool story, bro. Still a space racist, though.
I have to admit, it's hard to not feel a little bit bad for Lysander when we join back up with him and immediately read about him recalling some of his childhood trauma as he trudges through the desert. Cool, Octavia. Allowing / maybe outright causing a child to break his arm all over this mind's eye thing. Even Aja was like, don't. And yet Octavia, do.
Well, I mean, it's the gold culture of abuse. Half of their thing is, well, I take pride in the fact that I was physically and mentally abused to make me the person that I am. And by God, I'm going to make sure that the next generation is physically and mentally abused so they could be as tough as me.
The thing is, like, we do see families where that isn't the case. I mean, in Iron Gold, Cassius is talking to Lysander about his father, and Cassius tells Lysander that the only time his father acted disappointed in him even was when he was kind of running around just partying and having fun or whatever. So it's not all gold families. Not all gold.
Right.
Not all gold, y'all.
Yeah. I mean, the Telamonai, of course.
Yes, exactly. That's the other good one I was going to bring up. Kavax out Telamonis, best dad ever. Particularly at least best dad in Red Rising.
Yeah.
But still, this is kind of something else because if we set aside things like Nero putting the jackal out as a baby to like weather the elements or whatever, this level of abuse where it was like Octavia scattered seeds or something on the stairs to make Lysander break his arm because she knew he wasn't using the mind's eye properly or whatever. That's still pretty sus. Like, that's still pretty rough, even for gold.
Oh yeah, I mean, I'm not saying that it wasn't, yeah, egregious. It was. It's just, and this is of course the problem with Lysander, is that he always goes to that point and never goes, oh, maybe this is indicative of larger societal problems amongst the golds, and perhaps these can't be rooted out just by sticking to traditional values. That's not our Lysander.
Yeah,
No.
for sure.
It also does go back to some of what we've talked about before, which is like there's a degree of it feels like sometimes that trauma is being used to soften or make more sympathetic a character that otherwise would not be in any way sympathetic. And even that doesn't really like change our opinions of him. So it's kind of like, I understand why we need Lysander as a POV character, but it's really hard to give a shit about him as a character.
Well, and I think too that we have to remember that whatever he went through with Octavia the first 10 years of his life, he definitely had a better teacher and somebody who truly cared about him as a brother in Cassius. And he turned against Cassius in the end. I mean, he literally turned against him. And in Irongold, he tries to have this whole, oh, well, I'm doing it to save Cassius, but like, yes, I believe that's a part of it, but you're actually also doing it because you believe that gold should be the shepherd, quote unquote. It's just a better word for slaver.
You're shepherd only if you accept that a good 60% of your job is deciding which of the flock gets eaten that week.
He's a shepherd like Harmony is a shepherd, and we'll get into that more when we discuss Lyria's chapters.
Which is a bit from now, but yeah. So Lysander is badly injured, as we talked about. And while he's not alone at the beginning, they started out with 30 people or so, and others joined them along the way. They're low on water, and it being, a desert, it's freaking hot.
They don't know much about what's going on, other than that they can tell Ajax lost his battle in Heliopolis. And Lysander realizes how Darrow slipped the noose was beyond understanding, or it would be if the Golds fought as an army instead of a collective of greedy autarchs. We did this to ourselves and our men, my Praetorians, millions of civilians and loyal legionnaires paid the price.
At this point, it's really like step on his foot. When I step on your foot and say hello, Mr. Thompson, you say, did you not just, you just thought it. You just.
But if they just worked together in a collaborative manner, then everything would be better.
Yeah, like if they realized that they had a common goal that they could be better served by not insanely seeking out power and glory on an individual level.
And maybe also not being space racists.
Well, yeah, I mean,
If they
there
just
is
went
the
back
space
to
racism level.
being more space racists as a collective instead
Yeah.
of as individual power holders, then they could really make a difference in the world. Not a good one, but like a difference.
One of the people who rejoined Lysander is Cicero Alvodum, and he's definitely an interesting egg. On the one hand, Cicero thinks that they should abandon their Greys, who he believes probably won't make it through the desert anyway. But
I would just like to take this opportunity to say that I believe that Cicero is falling afoul of the kill your Greys trope. Okay, I'm done now.
sir,
Oh, yes, I know.
sir.
I know. It's Pride Month. I'm sorry. I'm sorry, but it was right there. Low-hanging fruit. Okay. On the other hand, Cicero's reasoning for why he, of all people, needs to survive is, to be quite honest, pretty solid. He argues, you think I want to do it for myself? You think I'm that venal? I'm not a Venusian or a loony sucking others dry. We Votum are builders. You don't know me at all. What I've had to watch, Darrow might have broken our planet, but Atalantia and her father have been raping it for years to feed their war. It's a lonely feeling when you realize your father, despite his many triumphs, is an invertebrate. I'll tell you that.
Apparently, Cicero's brother and sister stood up to Atalantia, but they were at Tyche, and Cicero doesn't believe they survived the storm. And he also knows that his father can't handle Atalantia on his own. You feel like there is, or maybe, I don't know if there is an alliance forming here necessarily right away, or just that there could or should be, but the seedlings of an alliance should be here because while Cicero is wanting something, aka leaving the Greys behind or possibly just straight up killing them, that is bad and awful, and Lysander doesn't want. At the same time, Lysander is also against, I think, Atalantia kind of stealing Heliopolis from the actual Mercurians who have lived here and run this planet forever. I'm not saying that these people are good people or anything, but I think it's really interesting that Cicero is like, yeah, my dad can't stand up to this bitch. Somebody needs to go do it. And I feel like there's a pairing here that could be helpful to both of them, not in the ways we want it to be, but you know. Anyway, granted, in the end, it turns out they don't have to worry about abandoning or killing the Greys because they all get caught in that sandstorm. Kalendor is trying to help Lysander to safety in that crashed bomber nearby. He knows they won't make it together, so he's like, go on. And he himself ends up surviving by diving into a hydro burrow and I think using the mind's eye because plot convenience to, I guess, I don't know, convince the hydra he's not there. Who knows?
This is an awfully useful thing for us to be introduced to in the second half of this series. And I'm not saying anybody's having a Kwisatz Haderach competition, but I'm not saying.
Oh, yeah. We talked about that when we covered Iron Golan, and I don't think you joined us for any of those episodes,
No,
but
I don't think
yes,
I would.
very, very much that. Turns out, though, that this whole thing that happened, him pushing them forward and hiding elsewhere, was for the best because those who did take shelter in the bomber were apparently captured by a Republic slash Rising shuttle. We call it the Republic. Lysander calls it the Rising, you know, whatever. Lysander cries about it until a disembodied voice tells him that he shouldn't be crying. He should be looking out for nocturnal devils who are coming to kill him. And P.S., the disembodied voice belongs to Apple. And other than warning Lysander, he refuses to help him. Though he does reveal that he wants to learn this whole mind's eye thing because it's fucking abalone's, and of course he does.
The devils who are coming for Lysander turn out to be some of Ajax's iron leopards, led by his dukes, Seneca. Lysander sets off a firebrand from the ship, which blinds him, but no worries. The mind's eye totes comes in handy for these sorts of things, and he's able to kill all of them. Apple applauds and gushes about the mind's eye being real, but trips up when he says he wants to use it against people who aren't Lysander's enemies, namely Atalantia and Atlas. Lysander is worried that Apple will kill him when he refuses to teach him the mind's eye, but nope, Apple lets Lysander forage from the dead and walk away, though he does take the grab boots and says he will be watching Lysander's trek through the desert to see if he survives.
I will say that the fact that Apollonius has been following him, or following them, but really just following Lysander throughout the desert all this time is just, dude, don't you have anything better to do? You're so obsessed with the mind's eye, or I don't even know. Like, I don't know that it necessarily started with that, but chapters ago, way early in Lysander's chapters, as he's going through the desert, he's like, it feels like someone's following us, but I just can't place it. So that's been Apple creeping this whole time, which, to be fair, not surprising that Apple's creeping, but.
No, but it is a little surprising that he's not on Venus.
Yeah. Again, this is just me doing cheap comedy. It'd be funny if there was a line where he's like, I was watching you sleep. Something like that.
I'm thinking
Make
more
it real
along the lines
Twilight.
of, oh my God. I was thinking more along the lines of Congo, the glyphs on the walls in the Michael Crichton books and the movie that everybody says is terrible, but fuck it. I fucking love that movie. I know it's not great, but I love it. We are watching you. And it's like glyphs of Apple in a ghost cloak behind Lysander in the dust.
Sometimes he's doing the vampire thing. He's like,
Here's a sesame cake. Sorry, if you don't know Congo the way I do, you won't get that, but somebody will get it and laugh.
It's been a while since I read that book, but I didn't the apes have like paddles or something? Like
They
big
did
stone
use
paddle.
weapons, yeah.
Yeah, something.
I've read the book like two or three times, but the movie is it is a little bit hilarious. It's not supposed to be, but it is. But I'm telling you, if you're listening to this and you have never watched Congo, please just go watch it. Anyway.
We'll see. All right, what's next? Oh, right. So Lysander walks north.
Blind, but not blinded anymore. Uncertain of where I go, but certain of one thing. Ajax abandoned me to the enemy. He tried to kill me. Darrow tried to kill me. Seneca tried to kill me. The desert tried to kill me. But I'm still here. Pain, the only proof I am not yet dead. Be it one of anguish or joy, my life is mine. I have earned it back, and I have no intention of wasting it.
See, now this is a point where I'm like, Pierce is either a very, very good author or a very, very bad one. And I'm leaning towards very, very good because Lysander's like 20, right?
Yes.
Yes. So he thinks like someone who's taken Philosophy 101. Perhaps for the first time. Blind, but blinded no more. Yeah, okay. All right. Look,
I think a
there's.
person can be two things that almost seem mutually exclusive but aren't mutually exclusive. So I think Pierce can actually be a really good author, but then at times be a really bad author.
Yeah, but it works for the character. I mean, we already don't
No,
like
it
him, and
does.
it's like, but it's like, it's so purple. It's just like, dude, there is no scenery, and somehow you are still managing to chew it. It's
Just
my hat is off to you.
devouring it.
In a monologue, in your internal
Yeah.
monologue, sir. This is an
Yeah,
achievement.
it's not like he's giving some speech to somebody. He's literally just thinking this in his head as he trudges through the desert.
Lawrence
Well,
of
I
Arabia
mean,
music playing in the background.
to be
Do
fair,
we rest?
he is trudging through the desert. What else do you have to do? I
Yeah.
definitely think to myself when I go running for like 4 or
100%.
five
I just
miles.
don't necessarily think in this way.
Well, has Ajax tried to kill you? Has Darrow tried to kill
You don't
you?
know my
Probably not,
life.
no.
Oh my gosh. Anyway, it's not quite 40 days and 40 nights of Lysander trudging through the desert, biblically, but it sure is hell.
He runs out of water, curses everything about Mercury, and curses Ajax to boot. But more than that, he curses the culture that made Ajax grow wicked because the peerless scar was formalized by Selenius to mark a gold worthy of respect, not worship. Our rigorous institutes were built to educate us to be shepherds, not cannibals. The world provided Darrow to show us how far we'd lost our way. To fight him, we did not find our path again. We strayed further and further, learning all the wrong lessons. It did not take Darrow to show them that they had learned the wrong lessons. It did not take Darrow to push them to lengths that were so far away from the ideals that he upholds. They were nowhere near those by the time Darrow showed up. Scapegoat's gonna scapegoat.
I don't know. It's like he's looking at a map, but upside down. And every time he looks at it, he just goes, aha, yes, north, that way. It's right there. It's right in front of you. You are literally thinking some of the words.
Yeah,
And
he says the things in his head and then does the wrong things.
yeah. And then, but the only thing to fix it is a return to our traditional values.
Oh God. Okay. He does reach Erebos. It's been drowned after its dam broke, and the Fear Knight has already been through there and impaled hundreds of Martians, or at least they're supposedly Martians. I think we can probably possibly assume that there are some non-Martians amongst Darrow's army, obviously. But anyway, some of them are still alive, and they beg Lysander to send them to the Vale. But when he tries to help, he just ends up with his feet planted on a mat that will activate mines if he moves. Oopsies.
Only when he does trip something, it's not an explosive, but a net. And now he's captured by Gorgons, who assume that because he doesn't have a peerless scar but does have a fancy razor, he must be a howler. And who do they imprison him with? But Lysander's cousin Alexander and his Knights of Elysium, or Arcosian Knights, or whatever they are. Regardless, they've all been tortured, and Alexander has no ears or teeth, among other scars. Ugh. Oh, boy, that's.
I will say this. How was Alexander talking the way he was with no teeth?
Talking very carefully.
If somebody has zero teeth, if all of their teeth, or even most of their teeth have been removed, particularly the front ones, I guess I get why Pierce wouldn't want to write the words that he's saying as if he had no teeth, but it threw me off a little bit because I still can't believe he had no teeth. The ears I get, because ears are seriously a thing in this series. It's something I will get into in the future because there's an ear thing in one of our next episodes coming up that really tripped me off to the like, okay, I'm done with just letting go of this whole ears falling off or getting cut off or whatever thing. But for now, no teeth. He has zero teeth in his mouth that Lysander can see at least. And he's still talking like a normal person. I don't know.
You ever read Joe Abercrombie's books? One of the main characters is a gentleman named Sand Danglokta, who's been captured by the enemy. And what they did was they removed every other tooth.
I mean, okay, but in this case, it's supposedly no teeth. So I'm still calling a little bit bunk on Alexander sounding normal.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Doing a lot of hard palate work. I don't know. All right. Anyway, of course, Lysander lies and pretends to be a Mercurian named Cato. Even though all but Alexander don't trust him, he does get to pick up the mood a bit by revealing that Darrow still has control of Heliopolis.
Yay! Cheers, I guess. Lysander does get tortured too. And I know he talks about once he actually finally gets with Atlas, or maybe even before that, he thinks about how he didn't want to tell the Gorgons who he was because he knows that Ajax at the very least is out to kill him. So who knows what the other Golds are up to or what they think of him or what they're going to do. But then as soon as the Fear Knight shows up, they have a sit down and it just bang turns into a plotting session. And there's a lot going on here. We learned that Atalantia has all sorts of icky proclivities, including that she's been sleeping with Ajax and using him in other ways since he was like 16. Gross. I just don't even know what to say about that because she's legitimately his aunt.
Well, yeah. Hang on. We were all in favor of Jon and Dany. We were all like, get together, you crazy Targaryens. You crazy gay
here. Speak for yourself.
All right. There were a lot of people in favor of Jon and Dany.
Yeah, so, speak for yourself.
Sure.
That was not me.
There are also a lot of people in favor of lots of other really weird and creepy pairings. So cool.
But it
still doesn't justify anything.
But a nearly middle-aged or straight-up middle-aged, I don't know exactly how old Atalantia is. If we're being generous, she's like 35 to 38, but I'm pretty sure she's more like early 40s. But even if she was only 35, she was sleeping with her 16-year-old nephew by blood and using her sexual control over him. Do this for me and I will reward you with sexual favors.
I looked it up. In Dark Age, she is between 46 and 48.
Boy, yeah, that would...
Which means that during the Rising, she was in her 30s.
Well, and Ajax is pretty much almost exactly Lysander's age. He might be a year or two older. I will give them that.
According to Red Rising Wiki, he's 23, so he would be about 3 years older.
Well, we also don't know how much time exactly has passed between Iron Gold and Dark Age. I don't think it's been that much, but time-wise in terms of when Lysander... when we knew he was 20 and was in the rim and how much time has passed since then. But regardless, for 7 years at least, so since she was in her early 40s, possibly 39, Atalantia has been fucking with her nephew. Her nephew by blood.
Yeah,
yeah, gotta say, that's worse than the pairings that we were talking about earlier.
Golds are gross for most of them.
Not all gold.
Most of the ones.
Yeah, hashtag not all gold.
Hashtag not all gold. Right.
Well,
all golds, I mean, I excuse the Telamonai.
Yeah, yes. The Telamonai would never.
No, absolutely not. But also, really, I think a lot of golds would never. It's been made pretty clear to us that Atalantia, her proclivities are beyond what even gold accepts.
Does this make her Baron Harkonnen and Ajax Fade Ratha? Yes. Yes. Okay. That's how that works. That's how that works, everyone.
Wow. Thanks for dotting that line for us.
Well, I'm just saying, if you're going to quiz out Tatarak, you got to have the rest of it. You don't.
You don't.
In fact, you don't even need to quiz out Tatarak, and I promise.
On top of that, she's also bioweapon friendly, and that she's about to unleash some sort of bioweapon that will kill rebel and loyalist alike so that she can finally take back Mercury.
Lysander asks, who are we if we kill a city that did not rebel?
Atlas replies, interesting. An idealist. Don't fret, it's a temporary condition.
I like how your Atlas was more dead in the voice / eyes than mine was, and I was trying pretty hard to make it dead in the voice. This leads to Lysander and Atlas coming up with their own plan that involves Lysander knocking Atlas out and taking him prisoner and escaping with Alexander and the others. Now, listen, how any of this is believable is still beyond me, but I think it was mostly because Alexander and the others have been tortured for so long that they're going to take any out that comes to them. But their escape involves traveling through a tunnel system as they are chased by Gorgons, dealing with something called milk bats that paralyze their victims and then feed on their bone marrow.
Which, fun, as Lysander says, damn the black market carvers. This is why the Board of Quality Control regulated them so assiduously. Men just want to create apex predators because it delights them. But then those predators kill off everything else, overpopulate, and break the ecosystem. I almost laugh at the irony.
Again, honestly, that
thinking the thoughts and then not being able to like
connect the dots. Thinking the thoughts, not connecting the dots.
Wow.
Oh, and then there's a high-speed grab bike chase. And did anyone else picture Phantom Menace pod races when reading this?
I went back to Return of the Jedi, thinking of the speeder bike chase through the woods.
Yeah, but that's through the woods. This is through the desert.
Okay,
and Pierce is also like 4 or 5 years younger than me, and I'm the youngest one out of the three of us somehow. So, yeah. He would have been like my baby sister's age when Phantom Menace came out in the theaters. So I absolutely believe that he wrote this thinking of those pod races in Phantom Menace.
They do make it out in the end, though both chasers and chasees are dropping like flies, leading Lysander to muse, all this for the thin man attached to the back of Drusilla's bike. Neither alliance fighting for love or hate, only the utility that one life will provide them. And when I think of that distant look in Atlas's eyes as I choked him out, that look that reminded me of Cassius when he went to face the Ra, I understand what they both knew. How foolish all this rage is.
Again, thinking the thoughts.
Yep.
My God.
But the only solution is racism.
Yep.
Yeah, as we know, Lysander is put to question, but passes all of the Howler's tests, even the one with a robot, with ease.
Darrow does come around while the robot is questioning Lysander and asks if the robot can work in the corner. When the techs say yes, he asks, then why is it jammed up in his face? They tell him it's on intimidation setting, and honestly, lol at Darrow's response, he calls it a bloody damn toaster and pushes the billion credit machine into the corner like he's setting a rotund child to time out. Stay, he says to it, pointing a finger. I love the fact that there's an intimidation mode. Like, there's a big switch on the back of the robot.
One end says friendly, and the other end says intimidation.
Yeah.
Interesting that when Rona arrives to bring Darrow a chair, Lysander thinks about how they're using children in their armies now. When she calls Darrow uncle, Lysander, she's Kieran's eldest, which means he's also probably realizes that she's about 20, but that doesn't seem to change what he thinks. You can't see this because it's a podcast, but I am rolling my eyes so fucking hard right now.
Yeah, his just disdain for, and I know you keep saying Rona, and I'm guessing that's how it's pronounced in the audiobook, but I see Rana, and that's how I'm always going to pronounce it. But the disdain that he clearly feels for her, like, at first, it's just, oh, they're using children. And then it's like, oh, wait, she's Darrow's niece. And he has to know how old she is if he knows exactly whose child she is.
Yep.
Of course, we also know that Glorastes demanded that his friend, Cato, be turned over to him, or Glorastes would not work for Darrow anymore, so lucky Lysander is released to Glorasti's custody.
He knows his time is running out before Atalantia releases her bioweapon, but he is also under surveillance, and so has to pretend to laze around the house. At one point, he is staring at himself in the mirror and thinks, I do not recognize myself. The desert has weathered my visage and stripped away much of its youth. My right cheek is sunken and peeling from sunburn. Carefully, I take the res flesh off my left cheek. The burn is livid. Drained of fluid, it gives the appearance of melted pink wax. It is not as grotesque as it must have been in the desert, but chunks of metal are still embedded too deeply in the drooping skin to be removed by anyone but an expensive surgeon or carver. The eye has gone smoky white. I am not repulsed. I always thought golds who kept their scars to be a bit vain, but I understand it now. Too much has always been made of my looks, as if I earned them by virtue of being born. This I earned. This is mine.
Blech, blech.
Yep, yep.
This brings me back, honestly, to when Victra, I think they did some carving with her back in Morningstar after they saved her from the jackal. But one of the things she kept was the torture scars from the acid from her bitch-ass sister, Antonia. And I felt like she kept it as a reminder of what she'd been through, right? Like, she could have gotten that fixed, but she didn't. But this just seems like a... Maybe it's just because I hate Lysander so much. This seems like a weak reflection of Victra. And I will say this. Okay, he earned his scars, right? He fell in the Iron Rain. He fought Darrow. He got stomped on the face. Shit was burning next to his... Fine. He says he's not keeping them as a vain thing, but I think he is because he knows he needs to be scarred in order to mean something.
Oh, yep. He probably thinks the song is about him.
Yeah. Well, love how Glorasti can just take Lysander into his wine cellar to have a conversation that won't be picked up by the monitoring devices.
Wi-Fi doesn't reach down there.
No, it doesn't. Have either of you ever seen the Kentucky Fried movie?
Yes.
Okay. That scene in the middle where they're doing the parody of Enter the Dragon, where they just keep pointing out listening devices to each other,
mm-hmm.
and then they have the conversation and nothing. Anyway. All right. So, that was sarcastic. But after Lysander tells Glorasti he wants to confront Darrow and help take back Mercury, blah, 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 Glorasti can't help but laugh when he explains. You could practically see that red girl hanging in his eyes, can't you? Gory damn Nero couldn't just slap her on the wrist. I blame him for all this. Him and that idiot Fabii and that idiot Bologna. Frankly, your ranks are replete with idiots. So many, in fact, one might suspect if they were a little poorer, a little more victimized, a little more burdened with trial, they might have had the common sense to band together instead of sniping each other in an operatic game of emotional suicide chess. To make matters worse, it hasn't changed, not a bit. They still bicker. Carthii and Saud, Votum and everyone. You expect them to hold hands with the Rim? You've always been a romantic.
That's very get off my lawn.
Of course, Lysander has to clarify.
You have to understand what I saw. I saw Aja hacked to ribbons and Octavia ripped from here to here. I saw the Jackal's bombs detonating and watched as Darrow pulled his tongues out. I saw my godfather ally with Darrow for the briefest flicker to down Lelith Afaron's ships before they destroyed my home. I saw all those people with all their plans strangled by the web they wove. I wanted out. To his credit, Darrow spared me and sent me away with Cassius.
Oh my fucking god, Lysander, listen to your own words for fuck's sake.
Yeah, so upsetting.
Why do you think Darrow pulled the Jackal's tongue out? I saw my godfather ally with Darrow to bring down those ships before they destroyed your home!
This is why we hate you, yes. Lysander. This is so such a good synopsis of why we hate him so much.
Like, we're not saying Darrow is the bestiest of the best, but seriously.
Yeah, given your options.
Listen to your own words. The things that come out of your mouth and even the things you think to yourself don't really correspond with what you do. Here's a fun tidbit, though. Side note, Quicksilver apparently commissioned a model of an orbital or possibly deep space city called Oculus from Glorastes, who actually made it look like a human eye. And it's interesting that Glorastes was so attached to a kid who apparently only spent a couple of summers with him or something along those lines, that he modeled it after Lysander's eye. What is going on there?
Totally a healthy relationship. Definitely.
It's literally, Lysander is described as having these sort of like crystal gold eyes, and Glorastes modeled this thing after the eye of a child he met a few times. Okay, guy. Anyway.
Everybody's got issues.
Glorastes goes on to complain that Darrow doesn't see him as anything but a tool. And listen, I will back Glorastes on this because, as we've discussed, Darrow feels that way about his actual friends. So I get it.
I guess you got to feel a little bit for old Glorastes when he tells Lysander, "I suppose it is human nature. Gold saw me as a novelty to flaunt. Mids let their jealousy label me a social climber. The lows loved me, then hated me, then loved me. All of them thought they understood my work, and maybe they did. But only you really ever understood me."
He was a child. How did he understand?
I don't know. I think somebody has a crush, but at least he didn't do anything about it. Looking at you, Atalantia.
I don't know what I think about Glorastes and his obsession with Lysander. I don't want to get into it. I don't even think I want to think about it. Anyway, they figure out how to freeze Lysander's monitoring spike. And as soon as they do, Exeter, who is Glorastes, he's more than just a manservant. He's like always there, whatever. Anyway, Exeter and the other low color servants come around to kneel before Lysander and hail the heir of Selenius because, of course they do.
Unlike when the Praetorians showed up, though, this time Lysander more than plays along, asking Glorastes to gather members of each color who are most loyal to the society and most influential and tell them the heir has returned and wants their help in taking back Mercury from the Martian marauders for the society.
For the society.
Yeah, the heir is returned. He's no Aragorn, son of Arathorn, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, we don't see him pushing open both doors of Helm's Deep.
We don't see him looking foul but feeling fairer.
My God, okay, I guess I understand that it's not the best comparison of when the Praetorians arrived and pledged their fealty to him as elite soldiers, essentially. And then these servants, these low colors, show up and kneel before him. I know it's not quite the same situation, but I don't like it either way. At least with the Praetorians, it was like they feel like they had pledged their life to House Loon. And so this is the remaining member of House Loon. So they're coming to do it again. And Lysander's like, I don't like it because this means that Ajax and maybe Atalantia are going to see that I'm not allied with them the way they think I should be. But in this case, it's like, okay, there's this, I don't like it.
Yeah, it's the low colors basically going, well, if there's one thing we like, it's being oppressed. I also don't understand why they're so attached to the mythology of Selenius. I can understand a gold being attached to it to an extent, only to the extent that it is going to further their own lust for power. But I can't understand low colors who didn't say specifically work on the moon.
Exactly.
In the palace.
These are Mercurians. Why is it Mercury that is so obsessed with House Loon and the heir of Selenius? I don't understand it. And there's no explanation for it. And listen, Pierce did build that story up in Iron Gold. So I'm not saying this is like an error in the writing or whatever. I'm just saying that it's one of the very few gripes I have with this series is that there's no explanation as to why Mercury specifically is so hard for them to conquer, why they are so loyal to the society. And maybe that's something that'll come out in the future. maybe all of the low colors there knew what they were doing. They weren't just sequestered in mines and being lied to. Maybe I missed that. If that was the case. I don't know.
I sort of vaguely remember something about the golds on Mercury being generally less crappy, sticking to the original plan a little bit more. But even so, that's still like a plan where it's like, well, you're below us because that's how we keep splicing our genes. I could be a gold too. Yeah, if we wanted to splice your genes that way, but we don't.
Well, and I think that some of it might be more that they are considered and treated as members of society and taken care of. Maybe that's where Lysander's like shepherding thing comes into play, is that the low colors on Mercury feel like they're okay being sheep. And I hate to use that word. Yeah. I really do. But even the low colors in the Rim, who are actually, as we learned in Iron Gold, they were actually treated with more respect than they ever were in the core. And then after the Rising happened, once the Rim was able to separate from the core, they are abolishing the obsidian gods. They are bringing the reds to the surface, et cetera, et cetera. But there are still sons of Ares in the Rim. And I'm not saying there weren't on Mercury, but it seems like it's an island in the core. It's an island of people who are more behind the society and the way they were treated by the society than any other planet has been. And I don't know that there's really any good explanation or reasoning for it.
I don't think that there's been any great explanation as to why Mercury stands out as this haven of traditionalism. Maybe it's just one of those things where they all had to spend too much time staying alive. They were all just, okay, we got to work to make sure that the heat of Mercury doesn't kill all of us, and everybody was too busy with that to worry about the oppression. It's difficult to say, but I think what I can say is that the colors on Mercury that are not gold are dumb. But that's
that's your opinion, and apparently not theirs.
No. Do you want to have a say in how the government works? No.
No, we just want to be shepherded. In memoriam, the people who have died in these chapters, mostly Lysander's chapters, although we touched on some of them in Darrow's chapters, Seneca and the other Iron Leopards who tried to kill Lysander. Hard to decide if this is good riddance because they're assholes scenario, or a sigh, how did Lysander survive such an assault? Maybe we wish he didn't scenario, but they're gone now. That one Martian soldier Lysander helped before he got caught in the Gorgon's trap.
Poor guy.
And last but not least, Alexander's fellow Knights of Elysium, or Arcosian Knights, whatever they call themselves, Ignatius, Hadrian, Crastus, and Drusilla, who died to bring Atlas to Darrow. But also, how did they die and this loser Lysander live?
Milk bats don't like the taste of pretension. That explains it.
I mean, Drusilla lived up until the very end. Drusilla was the one who had Atlas on her bike, and they all crashed into Rising HQ, and Drusilla was dead. Like, she was alive up until the very last moment.
And then, yeah. Well, it's because he has the mind's eye. That's why he's still alive.
Yes,
the mind's eye. All-knowing, all-seeing, all-protecting.
Anyway, as we close out the episode, we just want to give a shout out to our heroes, to your patron, Tommy of the TKOK Podcast Network. Thank you so much for supporting us once again. I'm Tara, along with fellow host Nick, and practically permanent guest host Seth. Don't forget that you can always hit us up at Sagas and Sass on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter, or email us at sagasandsass@gmail.com with any comments or thoughts you might have. Our next episode will cover a little more than half of Lyria's POV chapters, starting with her single chapter in part 2 of Dark Age and continuing through chapter 70 of part 3 of this book. Please consider supporting us at patreon.com/geeksaga_entertainment for early access to our recordings.
Thank you for listening to the Sagas and Sass podcast. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter at Sagas and Sass.